Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA, for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, the past is more recent, and the emotions are a bit fresher. We'll be talking about dogs finding the remains of people in fire zones. And just to make clear up front, these are not people who died in the fires, but people whose cremated remains were in a place that burned in the fire. Let's unpack this with our regulars. Mark Tveskov, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Chelsea Rose, good to see you again.
Good morning.
And we have with us Mike Newland with Environmental Science Associates, where he is the Northern California Cultural Resources Director. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And Lynn Engelbert joins us as well. She's with the Institute for Canine Forensics and is a canine search specialist. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. Let's start with you. We've had things like drug detection dogs for a long time, bomb sniffing dogs. How wide a field is canine forensics now?
The field right now, canine forensics is kind of a broad scope. What we do on a normal day-to-day basis is we take our dogs out and we work with archaeologists, cultural resource management organizations, native tribes, Forest Service, a number of different organizations looking for historic and prehistoric burials so that they can be protected.
So prehistoric burials, we're talking potentially remains that have been in the ground for a very, very long time then. I mean, and dogs can sense that difference from the surrounding terrain?
They absolutely can.
Wow. Are some breeds better at some skills than others? I mean, are there certain dogs that are better for detection of human remains, some dogs better for detection of other kinds of artifacts?
Well, actually, we use dogs that have a working heritage, hunting and herding dogs mostly. We've got everything from Border Collies, German Shepherds, Labrador Retrievers, the herding and the hunting dogs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so these are, all right, so the kind that you expect to go round things up are the ones that are going to do well at this. Mike Newland, you have some experience, obviously, in canine forensics and archaeology. How did you come to this crossover with basically with dogs?
It was actually, we have a sort of a group of principals running this effort right now, and my buddy Alex DiGiorgi, who is principal over at Alta Archaeological Consultants here in Santa Rosa, he initially started working with the dogs for the Tubbs Fire. And I think he did like a weekend or two with them, and it was entirely an experiment. It was sort of a word of mouth. They knew people in common, and they had been contacted to try to get a couple remains out. And then some local press got out, and they had 40 requests. Mm-hmm. And Alex contacted me and said, "Oh man, I need some help." And so I hopped on board, grabbed some of the people from ESA, and we put the word out. And so we helped out Tubbs Fire, and which was a very moving, intense experience. And Alex and I sat down afterwards and said, we need to do this. We've got to figure this out. And so we've been talking with Lynn and Adela. We've got kind of our team together. Adela works is with ICF as well. And we did the Carr Fire. I went down with Adela and Lynn and did Woolsey. And we've been really immersed in trying to respond to the campfire for, well over a month now.
I keep pointing this out because it confused me at first. Dogs finding remains in these circumstances is not about finding victims of the wildfires. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. These are people that were in urns, bags, boxes, whatever, stored in the house. And their ashes are now in with the ashes of the home that burned.
Lynn, was there an established protocol for this? Had it been done before the Tubbs Fire?
It had not been done before the Tubbs Fire, Jeff. This is something that we discovered purely by accident, by a gentleman who lost his mom and dad, talking to Alex, who talked to another archaeologist who said, use the Institute for Canine Forensics. That's what they do. As far as the protocol, our dogs are trained to find human remains anyway, from fairly modern to hundreds to thousands of years old. Native cultures practiced cremation hundreds and thousands of years ago. So they were already trained to do that, but we have been developing this protocol since the Tubbs fire, and we keep fine-tuning it every time we go out.
I'm struck by the ability that dogs, they're actually distinguishing between types of ashes. So they're able to distinguish, you know, the ashes of the home, for example, from the ashes of the human being whose remains were contained there.
Absolutely. We all know that human beings have a very distinctive odor, and dogs have been trained to find live humans and dead humans for a very, very long time. We've used it since the World War I, and the dogs, apparently, which we found out, we do not lose our very distinctive human smell even after cremation.
Wow, that is amazing. We're getting into a whole new ground here in Underground History this month with Chelsea and Mark, our regulars, Mike Newland from Environmental Science Associates, and Lynn Engelbert from the Institute for Canine Forensics. Questions and comments from you are welcome. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chelsea and Mark, is this something you had heard about before? I mean, when it first happened?
No, I'd never heard about it. We had worked with the Institute for Canine Forensics up in Shampooey State Park. We were looking for some mid-19th century unmarked graves. And so we'd worked with them, and I'd learned a little bit about what they do. So when I first heard about this effort, I thought it was really cool. And it really kind of, to me, speaks to the ways in which communities and populations are having to adjust to, you know, in Southern Oregon and Northern California, we're hearing about the new normal, which is the smoky summers, the catastrophic wildfires. So a lot of different types of partnerships and collaborations and plans are being created to kind of react and adapt to these things that never were an issue before. So I think when they first started looking into this, nobody ever thought this would have to be a regular thing that, their volunteer efforts, I think, are getting pretty stretched because now it's like four fires later and the need was obviously there. So it's great that they were able to pull together this collaboration.
And so, Mike Newland, just in the ones you've been involved with, how many different do you keep track of the numbers of sets of cremains you've been asked to locate?
Yeah, we do. We are trying to quantify things as we go along. I know, and Lynn can correct me here, but we have to be over 200 homes now between the fires the last 2 years. It's got to be approaching 250, I would imagine.
And so is it a fairly common thing then? I mean, does it happen more than we think that somebody's going to have cremains in their home?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, we've done some sort of informal querying of folks when we've done public presentations about this. And generally we're getting, you know, kind of a ballpark of about 10% of the audiences have got some sort of cremains at home. I have the cremains of my son at home. My dad has the cremains of my mom. It's fairly common, and I think it's worth pointing out. And I'm glad Chelsea kind of alluded to it. This is a volunteer effort, and we put thousands of hours into this, and part of the thing we're kind of trying to wrestle with right now is to get this on FEMA's radar. And the radar of the state offices that do the cleanups. For us to really try to do this on a volunteer basis for something like Camp Fire, they had 7,000 homes burned.
Right.
It's beyond our means. And we have to be able to get in and get out of there before they come in to do cleanup. So we have a very narrow window of time. And Lynn and Adela have been doing amazing work talking directly with the property owners, the victims of the fire, to get us out there and arranged. And then Alex and I have been doing the recruiting, trying to get the archaeologists to team up with the dogs. It's not easy work, to try to do it on a volunteer level is particularly, you know, as Chelsea was saying, you know, if this is going to be the new normal, something's got to change on how this is structured.
So a window of time and a window of conditions. I understand, Lynn, that for example, it's best if the area where the cremains were stored not be disturbed. Somebody shouldn't go sifting through there before you bring the dogs in. Is that right?
Absolutely. We have a very high rate of recoveries if the area has not been disturbed. However, if people go in, they are normally looking for the urns, and in probably 98% of the cases, the urns are gone. It doesn't matter what it is that they are made out of, whether they're in plastic bags and cardboard boxes or brass containers. Even the brass containers will go away. These fires burn very, very hot. So going in and looking for the urns just doesn't work. And most people, when they do go in, they have these screens and they sift. And what that does is just spread the ashes all over the place. When the dogs go in, they still have the scent of human cremains, but it's everywhere. So
okay.
They can't pinpoint. Normally, it turns out when the dogs go in and then the archaeologists go in and begin the recovery measures, it turns out to be a homogeneous pile of human cremains. And that gives the dogs a large scent to find and to alert on. But if the ashes have been sifted and scattered everywhere, all they do is get scent, and they cannot pinpoint a specific area.
Yeah. Hi, Lynn. This is Mark. I was curious about what you just said and thinking about these homeowners coming back to these destroyed homes and with screens to go sit in. Where is the priority? How do they prioritize the things they've lost? Are they going right to try to find these urns? Like, how are they thinking about the things they've lost and the kinds of things they're trying to find? Do you have a sense of that?
I do. I cannot tell you how many times I have heard the homeowners say, the only thing I want out of this house is my loved one's cremains. That's all I want. I've heard, now that I have, you know, John or Mary or some, whatever the name is, I'm just going to turn around and walk away, and I'm never coming back because now I have what I needed. This has been devastating for them. And if you can imagine, they keep the human cremains, they keep their loved ones' cremains for a variety of reasons. They can't bear to be away from them. Dad passed away, and we're waiting until Mom passes away because they want to be mingled and scattered in the same place. There's just so many reasons why people keep the cremains of their loved ones. And to have lost them is devastating enough, but to know that their loved ones' cremains are going to end up in a toxic dump is just more than they can take.
Because that's what will happen in the cleanup process. They'll take a lot of stuff away from the site because you got plastics and you know, paints and all the stuff you had in the garage and everything all in a big melted pile.
Absolutely. And just the things that you have in your home are made out of petroleum products. Think about your carpeting and your upholstery and things like that. And those are toxic. So they are going to end up in a toxic dump. And the thought of your loved one, that being their final resting place, is literally more than some people can take. Psychologically, it is devastating.
So you must get some really powerful emotional reactions when the dogs do find the cremains.
Oh, my. I think it's hard to describe. You walk onto a site, and this person who has almost given up hope of ever having their loved one back so that they can do whatever it is they wanted to do with them, some people are literally sobbing on the ground, just devastated. And when we go in and the dog has an alert and the archaeologists come in and they do their magic, I tell you what, it's amazing to watch them. And we recover this pile of cremains and we hand them to them in a Ziploc bag. And the change is absolutely 180 degrees. It's amazing. They are so thankful and so relieved. And many of them have said, now I can proceed with putting my life back together.
Wow, that was a major step for them to be able to do that.
Huge.
Mike Newland, what is it like? I mean, for somebody who works on archaeological projects, which is generally about the remote past, I mean, this is very fresh stuff and very fresh emotion. I mean, we're not talking about things from decades ago.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of the times, the first time that the people have been back to this location is to do this. So they're in a trauma state, really, and they're returning to the site of the trauma, and they're doing the most intense thing that they can do, you know, the victims, is to come back and try to get some closure on this. So, you know, I work a lot with Native American tribes. They have a very close connection with the remains and the sites of their ancestors. And so that can be a very intense emotional experience working with them. But the most of the time, you know, they don't know personally the people that we're recovering. And it's very intense. And I have a friend of mine who is an archaeologist who works in Puerto Rico. And just talking with her about their teams doing coastal surveys while their own houses are being, excavated out of hurricane damage. This new normal is, we're all having to think outside the box. There's no box anymore. We're all in the climate change business now. We're all in habitat restoration. We're all in disaster recovery. Every industry is going to be affected by this. And we've started to think about maybe we need to have therapy. And, you know, if we can get budgets for this, maybe we should probably have some therapy in there for people, because it is really an emotional, intense response that you have.
This is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange, in a very different realm from usual. Our regulars, Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose, in the studio with me. Mike Newlin is from Environmental Science Associates. Lynn Engelbert from the Institute for Canine Forensics. We're talking about recovering human cremains, pre-existing cremains, from fire zones where the houses around them have burned down and dogs used to help recover them. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Lynn, I understand you have experience in New York after the September 11th attacks for similar kind of duty.
I do. My old dog, Lucy, was cross-trained. Her foundation was in live find, but she was cross-trained to find human remains as well. And I have been part of the FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Task Force system for 27 years now. And Lucy and I did get called to go work with the Urban Search and Rescue teams in New York during the recovery operations. We were looking for literally bits and pieces of human beings. And her first find was 5 minutes after we walked on the site. And that means that tiny piece of that human being can be used for DNA to bring that person's family at least an element of closure, knowing that their loved one did, in fact, perish, you know, when the towers came down.
So here again, we were talking about it's not archaeology in the sense that we're used to. It's a very modern sort of thing. And this is a realm that I guess you're probably introducing into coursework at SOU, Mark Tveskov?
Well, yeah. I mean, the traditional model of archaeology is kind of this ivory tower enterprise where you're looking for deep antiquity. And one way or the other, archaeology and science generally has to be part of the world. I was going to say modern world, but it's the postmodern world where we're faced with these kinds of threats like climate change and social inequality that is expanding every year. So we got to engage local communities in many different kinds of ways. So this is an example of that.
Mike Newlin, do you anticipate a field, if one doesn't exist already, of climate change archaeology?
Yeah, actually, it exists. And I'm a committee chairman of a group that looks at that in California, and I sit on a committee that does it nationally.
I want to ask Lynn again about another case. You apparently used dogs in an attempt to find evidence of Amelia Earhart at Nico Mororo.
We did. June, July of 2017, TIGER, which is the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, and National Geographic teamed up to bring a team of four dogs from the Institute for Canine Forensics along with a lot of other scientists doing a lot of different work on Nikumaroro. Tiger's research has a theory that when Amelia was headed for Howland Island, she ended up being blown off course, and because of low fuel, could very well have landed on this massive flat reef on this little island called Gardner Island, which is now called Nikumaroro. And I can't talk too much about it because of contractual obligations with National Geographic, but we did take the dogs in there. They did find scent, and the results of that have not been determined yet. But we do know that in an area there was a castaway that perished, but who it was right now, we aren't particularly sure. But that was a fantastic. We did not know how our dogs were going to be able to work in a hot, humid, tropical climate, and they did great. Right. The handlers were, some of us were a little bit.
You guys were wilting, but the dogs did fine. Yeah.
No, the dogs did great.
Yeah. I'm betting on Tom Hanks.
Right. Tom Hanks would have been fine. Mike Newland, we have to go in just a moment, but I wanted to ask about that. You mentioned trying to bring this to the attention of FEMA. Do you have much response from disaster people so far about expanding the use of this and finding a way to make it a not volunteer operation?
Yeah, boy. You know, what we've gotten, we've been able to make contact with a few folks here and there, and they've all been very interested and supportive, but they're not the decision makers, and the decision makers have not been, basically just haven't been returning our phone calls, okay, which is unfortunate.
Got 20 seconds, you want Chelsea?
We're still looking to find the right person.
To make these decisions, yep. We're starting to reach out to our congressman to help.
Oh, okay, good. Well, so we'll see what shakes off down the road. But this is amazing work, using dogs to help recover human cremains from fire disasters in Northern California so far, but probably in other places down the road as well. You heard about the example at the World Trade Center at 9/11. Lynn Engelbert from the Institute for Canine Forensics, Mike Newland from Environmental Science Associates, Chelsea Rose, Mark Tveskov, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.